Hello, SFIA audio listeners. In this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, we'll take a look at what sorts of alien behemoths might be possible under known science. To hear it and every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur. Life is incredibly complicated, but for most of Earth's history, it was much simpler. Is it possible the universe is full of planets with very simple life, and complex organisms are rare? There are billions and billions of stars in this galaxy alone, and billions of galaxies with their own seas of stars, and likely most of those stars have planets. Even if only 1% of those had a planet reasonably akin to Earth, and in a warm orbit around its own star, there should be at least a billion places like Earth out there where life could have arisen. And this is the crux of the Fermi paradox, the big question about where all the alien civilizations are, because the sheer volume of worlds out there life might have arisen on seems to demand that examples be so numerous that surely some made it to our level or higher and went on to settle the galaxy. This gives us what we call the filters of the Fermi paradox, or the great filters. These are hurdles on the way to that goal of being visible galaxy-wide, and specifically by us, that presumably exists between a solar system forming and the day it sends its own colony ships to claim new worlds. Some of those we call late filters, problems civilizations like our own might still need to face on our road ahead, like finding out if interstellar colonization is even practical, or avoiding existential crises like artificial intelligence. Others are middle filters on the rise from animal to where we are now, like if fire can be safely and practically used on that planet, or sophisticated intelligence is a trait evolution is prone to producing, while yet others are very early filters, those we qualify as rare sun or rare earth filters, like if a star is in the right size range or has sufficient metallicity to allow rocky planets, and if a rocky planet was the right mass and temperature, contained enough of certain substances like surface water or elements like phosphorus or nitrogen. We've explored many of these filters before and how they might be stronger filters than we think, or even weaker filters, such as when we've explored biology based around ammonia or silicon instead of liquid water or carbon. But one we've never spent much time on, and which is sort of staring us in the face, is the possibility that life never gets very complex. That the galaxy might be full of planets where the most sophisticated things on it are algae and lichen, or where cells never developed nuclei, never got multicellular, or developed sexual reproduction. That life might be common enough, but that it rarely gets very complex. Now, what do I mean by staring us in the face? Well, a couple things. First, life has been on Earth for around 4 billion years now, and we still don't know quite when it first emerged, but it may have been about as soon as physically possible. We don't know if that was good luck or if life just starts emerging very nearly as soon as the conditions permit. It could be that worlds identical to Earth on average need trillions of years for life to pop up, and we are just the outlier. And indeed, Earth's conditions changed a lot since life first emerged. Nonetheless, it is hard to ignore that for the supermajority of Earth's history, simple life has existed on the planet, and the periods with an absence of life and now with complex life are both combined a lot shorter. Perhaps half a billion years after Earth formed, life popped up, possibly sooner or a bit later. Then around half a billion years ago, we get the Cambrian explosion, and we have a period over 3 billion years in the middle of that where life was quite simple. Indeed, one could argue that once complexity started rolling, it rolled real fast, and more so when we consider the sample size. Because here's the other thing, we can say humans dominate this planet, and that's true enough, but the vast majority of biomass is simple organisms, and a pound of those organisms is trillions of them, where it's barely one smaller organ of a larger organism. Think of evolution as flipping a coin each time a new organism emerges. Heads, it's done better than the average organism on its genetic lottery. Tails, it did worse. A human generation of 20 years might produce 2 to 4 new organisms who get that coin flip, and several billion humans planet-wide flipping those coins in a generation. While bacteria in a single cup of water, or a single human stomach, get to flip those same numbers of coins and do it often in as little as a single day, not a human generation of decades. In that sense, there is more evolution going on in a single human stomach than the entire human race. We are probably several million generations removed from the first mammal, and likely not even a billion generations removed from the first ancestor we dub an animal. Yet any modern bacteria has around a trillion generations since that first bacteria arrived, in which they have not fundamentally altered that much. That is, of course, oversimplifying, but for all that multicellularity has separately evolved a couple dozen times that we know of, that's actually still very uncommon when you consider the sample size, then contrasted to the evolutionary events inside multicellular organisms. You, the epitome of complexity in nature, have trillions of cells in your body, and most of them are bacteria, and the remainder are mostly simple red and white blood cells. There are literally hundreds of times more bacteria in your body alone than there are living mammals on this planet right now. We estimate perhaps 130 billion mammals alive today, across 5,500 species, and humans making up an amazing 6% of that these days. Most of these have a generation of a year or more, and so we might estimate around 10 quintillion mammals have ever lived. For scale, that's how many grains of sand we believe exist on our planet, across all its beaches and deserts. If you wrote down the name of every mammal who ever existed, so tiny it could be inscribed on one of those grains, you would need all those beaches and deserts for your catalog. But we estimate nearly a trillion times that many bacteria are alive at this very moment and reproduce around once a day, for over a trillion days. That means there's been a trillion trillion times as many of them as mammals. And again, for most of this planet's history, neither mammals nor any of our complex cousins like birds, fish, and reptiles were even around. Let's put this in some scale. We said we had as many mammals ever living as grains of sand, but if all those grains of sand were the current organisms on Earth, only one of those grains would be mammals. Not even one per species, just one for all. Now let's imagine the solar system's history as a clock, which we'll semi-arbitrarily put at 4.8 billion years just to make each hour 200 million years long. The sun formed at 1 in the morning, 4.6 billion years ago, and about 1:30 a.m. the moon had finished coalescing. By 5:30 a.m. life had emerged, possibly a good bit sooner. Eukaryotic life with cellular nuclei didn't pop up till early afternoon. We think the first fish fossil is from 530 million years ago at 9:21 p.m., the first insect fossil, 10:05 p.m., the first amphibian at 10:10, the first reptile at 10:26 p.m., the first mammal at 10:57 p.m., the first bird at 11:15, the first primate and the last dinosaur, both 11:40 p.m. Australopithecus arrived 1 minute ago, and Homo sapiens about 1 second ago. All of human recorded history is in the last tenth of a second of this planet's single day. The whole universe is just 3 days old, and the sun dies late tomorrow night. Stars will form and live and die for a year or two to come. Bigger ones might live for just a few minutes, the smallest for a year, much longer for life to develop on them. So not only do we see that virtually every class of the animal kingdom sprang up in under 4 hours of that planetary day, we see the entire animal kingdom in its modern phylum and classes isn't even 3 hours old yet. There's debate on how many other kingdoms there should be in taxonomy. The original two of plants and animals, flora and fauna, obviously doesn't even include bacteria, most of all life now and in the past, and also we aren't really sure where to put the beginning on plants. But the other thing that Clock reminds us of is that advances can happen fast. Our Great Filter series has a handful of episodes covering billions of years, and one of those is rare technology. And as we noted, technology is only seconds old on that planetary clock, and less if we start after the Stone Age. Things can snowball quickly. For around a million years, technology for humans meant fire, sticks sharpened in fire, and stone knives and axes. Sometime in the last 10 to 30,000 years, only a few percent of the time we had technology, we finally started getting a bit more serious about it and transitioned from the Paleolithic era to the Mesolithic era. Pottery, agriculture, and several minor but noteworthy inventions start appearing, And only for a few percent of that time have we really been doing science and spitting out new technologies like a machine gun. This episode is not on radio technology, which already has its own entry in our Great Photo series, as does the idea that intelligence might be rare, but it demonstrates that things can avalanche quickly and in a small group, but only once it gets going, and we can fool ourselves with numbers and scale. Whatever the odds of any of the individual big steps in evolution since tetrapods emerged, they were vastly more likely on a per-organism basis than multicellularity is. And we tend to look at multicellularity emerging many times that we know of and assume that surely it is not a filter. But we need to be mindful that the period between when life emerged and when multicellularity first appeared is longer than the period that animals have been around, along with every mutation they have accrued, and that there were trillions and trillions of times more candidates to mutate multicellularity from than the entire pool of animals. So every mutation an animal has had is vastly more likely, again on a per-organism basis, than multicellularity or any of the other early mutations from that 3 billion year period. It is also a far bigger statistical pool, making it easier to speak with confidence about. 10 people each flipping a few coins doesn't tell you much about if those coins were fair and balanced, or if one might have been 55% likely to come down heads. Similarly, some trait that popped up in a single species that might only have 100,000 living members over maybe a million generations is certainly a bigger pool, but it isn't anything like the immensity of those bacteria numbers and generations. So while conditions unique to Earth might alter the probability of a simple life form's mutation catching on, we should be able to speak with real certainty, at least to an order of magnitude, about how likely the mutation was to occur in the first place. We do not know the odds on that first life form that emerged. It might be some fluke event that even on a plant-sized object over a trillion years was lottery odds of happening, or it could be something so common that it actually happened on Earth repeatedly, but those future protoorganisms always failed to flourish inside an existing ecosystem. We can say it's not more likely than once in several thousand years though, back on proto-Earth anyway, as if it were, it would be very unlikely we wouldn't have several competing biologies by now, some of which function better in certain extreme conditions. Though we do not know that all life descends from that same single original protocell, we just tend to assume that it would have been able to spread its copies over the entire planet fairly quickly compared to something effectively identical popping up elsewhere. Similar to our reason for assuming that if intelligent life develops space travel in a galaxy less often than once in a million years, then a single species will settle that whole galaxy. It will get to every planet before a competitor a million years behind gets into space at all. For our purposes today, it does not actually matter if life popped up once or 10 times before it took hold planet-wide, and whether the first cell died before dividing and had to pop up 6 times before one managed to evolve enough to spread out of a thermal vent's habitable region before it went extinct, or if 50 different abiogenesis moments occurred over 10 million years, and our common descent is from 10 of them because one managed to evolve a DNA swapping or stealing ability and got DNA from 9 others in the process of everything else getting wiped out. Which is a valid caveat to add to our early discussion. One reason we evolve faster, as it were, is by sexual reproduction swapping mutant genes, and another is that our DNA is a lot longer than smaller organisms, so has more traits and more room for mutation. Those are the mechanisms that allow this explosion of evolutionary improvements in complex life. As such, I think it's fair to suggest that one of those rare complexities in early life that matters is some way to swap DNA. And we'll look at sexual reproduction as a possible Fermi paradox filter later today too. Though note that doesn't have to be sexual reproduction and doesn't necessarily have to be DNA swapping. We should not be assuming DNA is universal, especially as many processes don't use it in favor of RNA, and the properties of some other life blueprint molecule might be very different when it comes to mutation. Beyond that though, we can hijack other organisms. Mitochondria don't have any of your DNA in them. We do have examples of lateral or horizontal gene transfer in nature between species, instead of the usual vertical transfer we see from parent to offspring. Horizontal gene transfer is the primary mechanism for how bacteria get resistant to antibiotics or pesticides. Given that, we could indeed have some bizarre ecology on Earth of dozens of different origin life forms we mixed and matched relatively early on, as opposed to everything tracing back to a single original organism. In any event, the easier it is to share useful mutant traits, especially earlier on, the more it indicates that some of these key advances in early life were very unlikely to occur and might be a major filter themselves if the specific key mutation did turn out to be less likely than not to have evolved thus far. Typically once in a trillion years, not in 100 million, but we won that lotto. What are some of the complexities though? Well, some we can dismiss. For all that, we can make a good case that multicellularity is a rare mutation compared to those in modern organisms, it still separately happened many times, so it isn't some once a trillion years event we lucked out on by early draw. Neurons are probably too simple to qualify, and for example, as complex as a human eyeball is, all you need on the front is a light-sensitive cell, and there are several paths to making something eyeball-like, with some estimates arguing it could get from simplest photosensitive cells to full eyeball in well under a million years, and the eyeball is that classic example of evolution seeming implausible on first glance, pardon the pun. Many of the advancements in simple life fall into that zone where it would seem inevitable once you get that first mutation in that direction, and where evidence indicates it did happen more than once. Though we should be cautious using words like inevitable or likely when it took trillions of organisms alive at once for millions of generations for that step to occur. It was insanely unlikely, it just had a huge number of critters playing that lottery every day for a very long time. But speaking of photosensitive cells, one of the most important mutations to pop up was photosynthesis, and critically because it allows a vastly larger number of life forms and raw quantity of biomass to exist. A planet without photosynthesis might only support 1% of the population, and thus might need 100 times as long for a critical mutation to occur, so it's a very good potential filter. Let me put some caveats on that though. First, we think photosynthesis popped up very early too, possibly within a few hundred million years of life emerging, and before it there would have been a lot less life forms, as they might, for instance, have only been able to have dwelled within a few meters of a geothermal vent, which were hardly plentiful. This at least adds to its role as a possible great filter, as it is quite likely many plants might not have enough geothermal vents to support much of an ecosystem, and indeed they might be weak and short-lived, or so spread out that organisms could not migrate from the first vent to other ones. This reasoning is why I tend to like photosynthesis even better than eukaryotic life emerging as a filter, which is another good one we'll get to in a moment. However, photosynthesis is not a single massive jump. We think early photosynthesis might have been an adaptation to weakly absorb low wavelength light from oceanic thermal vents 3.4 billion years ago, not visible sunlight, and that cyanobacteria didn't arise for 700 million more years 2.7 billion years ago. If true, then this is a different process than normal photosynthesis, as typically this involves taking 6 carbon dioxide molecules and 6 water molecules and using sunlight to turn them into 6 oxygen molecules and 1 glucose sugar molecule. This early low wavelength photosynthesis would still have used 6 carbon dioxide molecules, but used 6 hydrogen sulfide molecules instead of water as the other material changed. Hydrogen sulfide is 2 hydrogen and 1 sulfur atom, as opposed to water, which is 2 hydrogen and 1 oxygen. This is not usually what folks mean when suggesting alternate biologies using sulfur, as it still ends with a glucose molecule, but you end up with 6 water molecules and 12 sulfur atoms left over. This is pretty hypothetical still. For one thing, we still don't know if geothermal vents are where life emerged, or anything about their typical frequency and properties, but it has the advantage that photosynthesis this way is producing molecular oxygen gas. Now, as we know, an oxygen-rich atmosphere is vital to larger and faster organisms like animals, but oxygen reacts to everything, so even once cyanobacteria arrived later on and began pumping out vastly more glucose and oxygen gas, it took hundreds of millions of years to build up to quantity as so much of the local rock could absorb it, giving us those banded ion formations. There's no reason to think the dynamics here on Earth would be the norm. Many plants might have cycled new geological material up too fast to get oxygen saturated ever, while others might have done it too slowly and poisoned life off before it adapted to heavy oxygen around. The weakest argument for photosynthesis as a great filter is that there are several different photosynthetic processes out there already, not all of which would require sunlight to function, and that we would expect sunlight to reach ecosystems on many planets. Some worlds might have 10 miles of ocean between their highest thermal vents and their sea surface. Some might have an atmosphere so thick the only light you ever saw on the surface was from lightning strikes. But those sorts of conditions should not be strong filters themselves, albeit they may both be significant ones. But we would still expect plenty of worlds with conditions like ours in that regard, not a vast scarcity of them. One way or another, photosynthesis had hit its stride long before the first eukaryotic cells arrived, and that arrival also came after our atmosphere had more or less settled into its modern form of mostly nitrogen and most of the remainder being oxygen. They are hardly newcomers, they popped up 2.2 billion years ago, but that still means they were sufficiently hard to evolve that for at least 1.5 billion years, they were no-shows, and most of that time with plenty of photosynthesis around to power huge ecosystems. And indeed, the vast majority of organisms are not eukaryotic, though their combined biomass is a lot higher than that of prokaryotes. And that's an important thing to note because people tend to think of eukaryotes and think of them differing by having a nuclei, which is quite true, but your typical prokaryotic cell is 100 to 5,000 nanometers wide, on an order of the wavelengths of visible light and near IR, hard to see even under a microscope, whereas a eukaryotic cell is typically 10,000 to 100,000 nanometers wide, though they can get a good deal bigger, and an ostrich egg, for instance, is a single cell. But just those typical ones represent a huge difference in volume and mass, meaning even bigger prokaryotes compared to smaller eukaryotes have an order of magnitude less stuff in them. While on the other end, smaller prokaryotes can have 1 billion times less material in them than one bigger eukaryote. Think of the typical eukaryote as a country, with 1 million to perhaps even 1 billion people in them. Now think of a prokaryote then as everywhere from a small shack one person lives in to a modern metropolis of 100,000. And the nuclei still is very important here, think of it as your capital city of that country, but in your eukaryotic cells, you might have 500,000 mitochondria, which we usually assume were prokaryotes and ones that existed before eukaryotes, since every eukaryotic cell has mitochondria. They are not just different because they have a nucleus, and that's why I'd emphasize the size difference. It's not a small dog and a big dog, it's generally a canoe and a cruise ship. And if you picture a big cruise ship with lots of little lifeboats on the side, that's your mitochondria, except there's way more. Sometime way back, a cell absorbed another cell but didn't destroy it and got a symbiotic process going on, presumably allowing mitochondria to massively simplify themselves into a power plant while the wider cell around them fed off that and fueled them. But we think this might have happened more than once, that eukaryotic cells might have absorbed something besides mitochondria. It's a bit of a chicken or egg situation now, because we tended to assume some bigger prokaryotic cell absorbed another one and this snowballed eukaryotes, but you can make a good case that bigger prokaryotic cell already had a nucleus, and that this is part of what allowed safe endosymbiosis to go on when it swallowed that mitochondria precursor and didn't digest it and survived it multiplying inside itself, which would not tend to seem safe or healthy. Without that nucleus, its DNA would probably have been damaged by the mitochondria growing all around inside it. Again, diagrams show you a tiny mitochondria inside a bigger proto-eukaryote, but not really to scale any more than solar models of planets, because while the size difference was probably much smaller in the original ones, modern human cells contain hundreds of thousands of mitochondria, and those original ones probably had plenty of room for a decent population too. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't have worked as too initially disruptive or explosive. We had the same thing having occurred with chloroplasts in plants, and nature shows us some other events of endosymbiosis. So I'm hesitant to say this is all that improbable of an event, but multicellularity evolved dozens of times, and to the best of our knowledge, eukaryotes evolved just once, and a long while after Earth had developed life, photosynthesis, and an oxygen-rich atmosphere. This also laid the groundwork for more complex multicellular organisms. There are no multicellular prokaryotes, though there's plenty of organisms like us who use prokaryotes heavily inside them, and not just mitochondria. This event, or events, as multicellularity evolved separately repeatedly, came after eukaryotes emerged, and so did sexual reproduction. Now, you can make a case that sexual reproduction is vital to complex life, but I think it's weaker to argue it's a filter, as life was quite plentiful before then, and some life such as fungi continue to reproduce both sexually and asexually. We also have a miscellaneous category of eukaryotes that don't qualify as animals, fungi, or plants called protists, and these don't all share any known common ancestor before that first eukaryote, but includes algae, slime molds, and amoeba, and sexual reproduction popped up in some protists pretty early compared to animals. In any event, sexual reproduction is a decent rare complexity filter, though I would tend to imagine not a very major one, and probably gets suggested as much because it's a bit scandalous or amusing to bring up. Once we get into the animal phase, obviously the ability to create sophisticated life forms, swap DNA, and have social and family structures is a pretty big deal. It's just that like multicellularity, it is not seen as quite the uphill lift to have gotten compared to eukaryotes itself. I have to admit, eukaryotes were not a favorite option of mine for a long time. My friend John Michael Gaudier sold them to me as his preferred early great filter, and he discussed them as an option in more depth on his show, which I highly recommend. I still tend to tilt more to a robust photosynthetic ecology as the stronger candidate, though it's close and both all good, and as a reminder, any filter that life has a decent chance of tripping over on its way to Galactic Empire adds into the whole. Years back, we listed off 50 commonly suggested rare earth filters that made a good case for being coin flip odds or far worse of passing, and even at coin flip odds, your chance of flipping heads 50 times in a row is 2 to the 50 or about 1 in a quadrillion. Which if true, even if none of those were worse, would mean it would be improbable for life to get to our current state even once in an entire galaxy, and indeed in its thousand nearest neighbors. What I mean by robust photosynthetic ecology, incidentally, is that it has to permit a level of biomass and metabolic energy flux similar to our own planet. It would be very easy for Earth to have more atmosphere than it does now, for instance, and have less sunlight as a result, or have deeper oceans and thus fewer options for life to get nutrients up near the top of the sea where sunlight can reach, or again for those thermal vents to just not be common and stable enough to allow life to flourish and migrate to other vents and eventually to other environments. All any of these things had to have done is slope evolution down to about half the speed to ensure virtually no place could have intelligent life yet and that most planets wouldn't remain habitable for the full duration. Indeed, Earth only needed to run maybe 15% slower on Darwin's ladder to have lost our oceans not long after life first crawled out of them. And even a planet identical to us but just a few percent lower in mass might already have lost that atmosphere and all life with it. But to return to multicellularity for a moment, and to wrap us up, I think we need to be mindful not to just wave aside the importance of that because it popped up independently, repeatedly, because it also did not. Even if we widen the concept of multicellularity to include non-human DNA organisms in us beyond mitochondria, like our gut bacteria, most organisms on this planet, both now and in the past, have not adopted a multicellular existence. Even when we broaden that to border on viewing complex ecosystems as something close to being an organism in their own right. And I would argue the line between large organisms like us and complex ecosystems made of many separate organisms can get pretty blurry, and I suspect can get even more blurry on alien planets with alien ecologies. Nonetheless, bacteria may not be king, but they sure have the numbers, and there's no reason you couldn't have an ecosystem that evolved toward filling their niches with larger organisms, either directly or in that hazy edge way our mitochondria or gut bacteria might count as. Food chains do not automatically go smaller to bigger, nor do they require anything of a specific size. Indeed, maybe left to itself, sans humans, life might have gone that way eventually, which as we discussed in the Gaia Hypothesis, some argue might be the final state of an ecology. However, it does not seem so inclined based on our past or present, and as we discussed in that same episode, the rival Medea hypothesis argues that biology is dominated by bacteria, and bigger organisms tend to pop up and go extinct a lot too. In this way, it may be that complexity itself, of any type, is the oddball in biology, and that when we get into the galaxy at large and land on Earth-like worlds, we'll find plenty of life, but none more complex than the simplest algae mat, and maybe not even as complex as that. One of the common worries about the Fermi paradox is that aliens might be common and prone to spying on us, and essentially keeping us in a zoo, or that civilizations might turn pretty restrictive and big brothery, and we'll be exploring some cousins of these ideas in next month's episode Fermi Paradox Chronos Scenarios, and then in Fermi Paradox Interdiction in May, but you don't have to look too far to see worrying trends on privacy and technology these days. Even before the internet, there were plenty of folks who traded your data around, selling it like a commodity they owned. But the internet made that so much more common, and artificial intelligence is only making both legal and illegal trade in your data easier. Just between 2021 and 2022, the number of victims of identity theft rose 41.5%. Even ignoring illegal use, there are public sites where your address, phone, family members, religious and political beliefs, and even license plate number can be found online. You do have the right to have that taken down, but you have to request it, and it would take you years to do it manually, just once. And you need to repeat that process every few months as data brokers continue collecting your data and creating new records using AI. But Incogni can turn the tables around and use AI to find your information and send takedown requests for you. All you have to do is sign up, give them permission to act on your behalf to delete data, and then they go to work, and your data goes away. You can check up on the progress and see who had your data and how detailed and risky it was considered. Incogni makes these data harvesters take your info down, and they keep doing it too, making sure that it stays down. Incogni is available to try out risk-free for 30 days. Use code IsaacArthur at the link in the episode description to get an exclusive 60% off the annual Incogni plan. Go to incogni.com/IsaacArthur and take your data back. So as mentioned, we'll be returning to the topic of the Fermi Paradox in a couple weeks to look at the Chronos scenarios, where a spacefaring civilization may actively seek to prevent or wipe out their own colonies. We've got a few episodes first, starting with a discussion of the theory, creation, and usage of Kugelblitz micro black holes for powering spaceships or entire civilizations on March 28th. Then we'll close out the month with a look at multi-planetary empires on Sunday, March 31st, to explore what nations controlling several worlds might actually be like and how they'd function. Then we'll start April off on the 4th with a discussion of space-based solar power and several other clean energy options from space that might be able to help us power not only our orbital infrastructure, but Earth itself, including options like Earth's own magnetic field. If you'd like to get alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to hit the like, subscribe, and notification buttons. You can also help support the show on Patreon. And if you'd like to donate or help in other ways, you can see those options by visiting our website, IsaacArthur.net. You can also catch all of SFIA's episodes early and ad-free on our streaming service Nebula, along with hours of bonus content like Crystal Aliens at go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur. As always, thanks for watching and have a great week.